From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. If music be the food of love, play on, or so wrote Mr. Bartlett in his book of quotations. And who are we to argue with him? On this week's show, we revisit some of the musicians who have visited with us. It's a Wait, Wait you can hum along to. First up, the intellectual accordion-playing duo, They Might Be Giants, also known as John Flansburgh and John Linnell.
They joined Peter and me and panelists Charlie Pierce, Faith Saley, and Mo Rocca. And we began by asking them about their long musical partnership.
You compose, you write, you sing, you perform together, but which of you is the musical genius and which of you is the hanger-on?
I think we both secretly think of ourselves as the hanger-on.
Really?
Actually, yes. Right. Aw, that's a true relationship.
I like that. I
mean, two Ringos, no waiting.
That's right.
You know, they say about a good marriage is one where each partner thinks he or she is the lucky one. So you guys are in like a good musical marriage there.
Right. I didn't say lucky one. I said hanger on. Get me off this train.
your songs cover topics not generally covered in your basic pop music. Instead of love and romance and sex, you are writing about things like James K. Polk. Does this just reflect your interests?
I think we write songs about all sorts of things, and we have a lot of, you know, love and romance type songs as well. But we just cover a broader range of topics.
Yeah, it's love for James K. Polk. That's what I mean.
That's right.
You know, as opposed to...
Yes, the love theme from the annexation of Texas.
Mm-hmm. The Gadsden Purchase. Was that his? I don't know.
Listen to you guys.
I think that was the rock opera, wasn't it?
We are your audience, is the point I'm trying to make. You've been doing, and this is much to the delight of my children, you started doing, about 8 years ago now, you put out a first kids record. You've got a new one.
Yeah, we've done three albums with DVDs for kids as well.
Which is great. Now, do you find it difficult to go from kid rock to grown-up rock and back and forth, or is it pretty seamless?
They're surprisingly similar. I think, you know, with the material that we do for adults, we just tend to go a little darker, you know.
Yeah.
It's creepier.
And are your concerts the same? I mean, the adults are...
No, those are radically different. I mean, the kids' concerts, basically the confetti machine is the star of the day.
And so you actually do... You'll do a kids' concert and then, I keep calling them, a grown-up concert.
Yeah, we have a problem
day,
with that,
right?
Too.
Yeah. What do you call
double,
them?
Double. We say adult shows, but that sort of sounds like, you know, porno or something.
Yeah. but at this point, having done so much, is there one that you enjoy more than the other?
I think we really enjoy the days off.
Yeah. Now, I know that you don't like this, but I'm going to mention it anyway, that you've been saddled with the term nerd rock. You don't like that association. I don't blame you, even though
it's a brand new decade. You know, we're just going to give up on worrying about it.
You're not going to worry about it.
Go nerd crazy on us, man.
Really?
It's really a generational thing. You know, I think, you know, we're older, and for people of our generation, it seemed like a very toxic term. But obviously, for people of the internet moment, it's a very positive thing. You know, I think people think of it as just being an enthusiast, you know.
Exactly.
Very positive.
It's really true. I mean, I, as a nerd growing up who was shunned and had, you know, problems being accepted, and I look around and I see the kids who are proudly out as nerds.
And I think geek is cooler, though.
Geek is cooler.
Technically?
Yeah.
Or empirically?
You're telling me I'm still a nerd and it's still not good?
You're more nebbish.
Yeah. So you guys do play and feature an accordion. Now, you don't usually play polkas, but can you tell us what happened the time you played the Polish Hall up in Wisconsin in the accordion?
That's right. It was at the Majeska Theater in Milwaukee.
Of course.
And apparently the audience was so into this particular song that we played that they jumped up onto the apron of the stage, which turned out to be a kind of flimsy cover for the orchestra pit in front of the stage.
Ooh.
And they all dropped about 5 feet. It was about 30 people in front of us who just suddenly collapsed into
like
the
an accordion.
Orchestra pit.
Wow.
Kind of like an accordion, yeah. They didn't seem upset. That's the other thing, is that they all seemed perfectly happy. They got up, and some of them went to the hospital to get checked for cuts and bruises, but nobody was badly injured. And apparently none of them had lawyers for parents. We figured
Thank
out.
God. Well, John Linnell and John Flansburgh, they might be giants. We've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You might be giants, but he really was a giant.
The man born Andre René Roussimoff, who's famous throughout the world as Andre the Giant, actor and pro wrestler. We're going to ask you three questions about this legitimate giant. Get two right, you'll win our prize from one of our listeners. Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who are John and John playing for?
Now they're playing for Merritt Desig of Chicago.
And whenever we have two people playing the game, like yourselves, you are allowed to collaborate. We hope we get to see into your creative process as you work through the answers.
Right. Yes.
Bitter fights.
Yes.
We couldn't have Lennon and McCartney on the show, so you'll have to do. Here's your first question. In addition to being one of the tallest, if not the tallest, professional wrestler ever, Andre the Giant held one other record, at least according to popular legend. What is it? A, he could speak more languages fluently, 8, than any other professional wrestler ever. B, he holds the unofficial record for most beers drunk in a set period of time. Or C, he wore the largest athletic supporter ever made by the Bike Corporation.
Ooh.
Wow.
Well, he was French, but I'm not sure he was a particularly well-educated man. Somehow the beer seems fun.
Yeah, the beer seems a little bit...
obvious.
Right.
And then the unlikely jockstrap thing, but...
That sounds like a kind of cheap joke that you'd throw in.
But that might probably be
the double reverse psychology that you guys are working.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm thinking double reverse psychology.
So what's your choice?
C.
Let's go with C.
You're going to have the largest athletic supporter, and your idea, if I understood
Suddenly that sounds like a terrible idea.
Was that... No, I'm trying to figure it out. It's the double reverse psychology is that it sounds... like it's the sort of cheap joke we'd make up.
Right,
exactly.
But because it sounds like we'd make it up, it's real. Because we're trying to fool you into thinking that it's made up because it's really real.
Right.
Yes.
Unless that's just what you want us to think.
Exactly. We could have made a cheap joke intending for you to think it was disguised as a cheap joke and real, but really it's just a cheap joke.
Oh, my gosh. Am I a butterfly dreaming I'm a human?
So what's your choice then?
We'll go with C.
You're going to go with C.
We're lost.
No, you were right. It was a cheap joke. It was actually beers is the answer. According to one eyewitness account, Andre once drank 119 beers in 6 hours, which is a record. He then passed out on the floor, and nobody could move him until morning. Still have two more chances here. This is not all lost. Next question. Andre the Giant had a successful acting career, most notably in The Princess Bride. But what was his first screen role? His first screen role as an actor? Was it A, as Bigfoot in a special two-part episode of The $6 Million Man? Or B, as the world's biggest baby in a laugh-in episode? Or C, as Napoleon in a dream sequence in a French art film about Napoleon?
He's too young to be on Laugh-In, right?
Yeah, he'd be too young to be on Laugh-In. Laugh-In is definitely no. Okay. The Bigfoot thing seems plausible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure, we'll go with Bigfoot, I think.
You're going to go with Bigfoot and the $6 Million Man?
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. Very good.
Oh.
He plays a robot Sasquatch built by aliens. All right.
Of course.
His bionic beer gut.
Exactly. This is your last question, and it all comes down to this. If you get this right, you win. Andre may have been inspired in his career by an early childhood encounter with greatness. Was it A, he studied classical mime in Paris with Marcel Marceau? B, playwright Samuel Beckett gave him rides to school? Or C, his first job was being a bodyguard for an aging Mae West?
Ooh, that's interesting.
Oh, I think I'm thinking C.
Yeah.
Mae West?
Because Mae West probably worked in France a lot.
Yes.
It just seems completely
plausible.
That one
plausible. Sounds right.
So you're going to go for the bodyguard for an aging Mae West?
We're going with that one, yeah.
You think that she would like a 7-foot-tall guy?
Whatever it takes, Peter.
All right. No, I'm pleased to say it was Samuel Beckett, actually.
Whoa!
Samuel Beckett drove him to school. Now, we can only imagine what those conversations were like. I should say, before people get upset, that the sole source for this story, which is widespread on the internet, is the actor Cary Elwes, who in the DVD for The Princess Bride tells this story. He says, oh yeah, and Andre told me when he was a kid, Samuel Beckett used to drive him to school. I wonder what those conversations were like, said Cary Elwes. Unconfirmed otherwise, but we don't want to live in a world in which Samuel Beckett did not drive Andre to school. Yes. So, there you go.
That beautiful generosity.
He didn't say a lot on the rides.
He didn't say a lot, no.
Beat.
Stop. That's right.
Carl, how did John Linnell and John Flansburgh do on our show?
Well, John and John needed two correct answers to win, Peter, but they had just one correct answer.
Oh. And oddly enough, Peter, when Samuel Beckett drives you to school, you never get there.
It's true.
That's right. All right, let's go. Start the car.
They stay. Curtain.
Beat.
Why aren't you driving, Samuel?
They Might Be Giants' new children's album is Here Comes Science. Their new children's book is Kids Go. They're out now and worth having even if you have no children. John Linnell and John Flansburgh, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thank you so much, guys. Thanks for being on the show.
See that bulletproof dress hanging from the clothesline. See the medical chart with the random...
Thank you so much. This week... we are spinning up our turntables and putting on our classic collection of interviews with musicians. Next up, a founding member of the great New Orleans funk band, The Meters, George Porter Jr. We were honored to have him join us along with panelists Roy Blunt Jr., Mo Rocca, and Amy Dickinson when we visited his hometown of New Orleans, Louisiana.
We began by asking him what it was like to grow up surrounded by music in New Orleans.
So, you grew up here in New Orleans. Yes?
Yes.
My understanding is that the children in New Orleans are given musical instruments before they can walk. Is that more or less true?
Didn't happen in my house.
No, no. But you started pretty young.
I was 8, yes.
You were 8 years old, and what happened? Did you?
Well, it was my mom sang in the Catholic school choir, so, you know, there was only an organ in there, you know, and I wanted to play something that I could carry around. I think she gave us both myself and my brother violins when we were...
Violins?
Yeah. Huh. I don't know. I ain't figured that out yet.
Yeah.
But that didn't work. And it was a few years later that I asked for a guitar. And
What if you can't play an instrument? Like, are you like an outcast in New Orleans?
That's, not at all.
That's what
not
Houston is for, isn't it?
Yeah. No.
I was just there.
No. The ones that don't play instruments usually become managers.
Yeah. Tell me about The Meters, because you guys are known as one of the seminal funk bands, and you guys kind of invented that. So if you could, for the record, tell me, what is funk?
I haven't figured that out. You know, one of the things that I've been trying to get away from forever is the labels that they stick on us as players, you know, because... I play jazz, I play, I play R&B, I play, I can play country. I haven't played it yet, but, you know.
Wait a minute, you've never played it, but if forced to, you could.
Houston is for.
I understand.
I'm kind of, you know, I like the idea of being just a musician, you know, and trying to live outside of the labels.
Right,
know.
Sure.
Where'd the name The Meters come from?
We, 5 of us stuck names in a hat.
Oh, yeah?
And it was 4 of us, the 4 musicians and Alan Toussaint. Yeah. And the manager pulled out a name. We never saw it, but...
He said it was the Meters. Wait a minute.
It's The Meters.
But we have to know, what were some of the other names?
Well, the name I put in was The Metrics.
Metrics?
Uh-huh.
Could your manager read? Is that...
you know, because the idea was we were supposed to pick out names that had to do with meter.
Mm. Oh, you know, I see.
Or timing. So, and that's what...
Was this when the metric system was really hot?
No, we hadn't gotten that far.
Let me ask you one last question, which is, we're not from around here, and we always love your music and New Orleans music, but the language barrier sometimes gets in the way. So I wanted to ask you about some of your songs. You can tell us what they mean. Hey, Pocky Away.
No.
Is that right?
Hey, Pocky Way.
Hey, Pocky Way.
Hey, Pocky Way.
Is that Creole? What is that?
I don't know. I was told. I was told by one of the younger Neville brothers, who Uncle Jolly, Big Chief Jolly of the Wild Chapel Tulas, told him.
English.
I told him that meant, if you don't want to play, get out the way.
Wow. Hey, Pocky. Hey, no. Pocky.
Hey, Pocky. Way. Hey, Pocky. Hey, Pocky.
Way. It's Creole for hokey pokey.
Right. Look a pie pie.
That don't have a damn look. I don't know what that was. There was, you know. Okay, I guess I should say that there were a few songs that when we were recording, management would put us in the studio. The tracks would be meter one, meter two, all the way to 10 or 12 or whatever. Yeah. And then we'd get sent on the road, and the album would come out, and those were some of the names.
Really? No idea.
What is it again?
Look a pie pie.
Good song.
Good. Mm-hmm.
I would listen to that and just think about this magical, amazing world of mystery about which I knew nothing. Mm-hmm. And little did I know, you were feeling the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, George Porter, we are delighted to have you with us. We've asked you here to play a game that this time we're going to call...
The Funky Meters. How about the Parking Meters?
It's a natural thing. The question to be determined today, what does a meter know about meters? We're going to ask you three questions about parking meters. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in their home answering machine. Carl, who is musician George Porter playing for?
George is playing for Rose Krupka of Metairie, Louisiana.
There you are. He's from round here. First question, the beach town of Surfers Paradise, Australia, enraged laid-back residents when they introduced parking meters back in the 60s. The town decided to mend fences with the surfers by doing what? Was it A, staging an annual Bash the Meter party where people could smash old parking meters with hammers? B, they introduced the meter maids, scantily clad ladies who put change in meters about to expire. Or C, they announced meters would be deactivated when, quote, the surfing was too good to leave.
Oh, gosh, that's fun.
I'm going to go with B.
You're going to go with B, the meter maid.
Meter maid.
Girls?
Yeah.
You're right. Always a wise choice. Always go with a beautiful girl. The meter maids of Surfers Paradise, Australia are a famous attraction there. They wander about in gold lame bikinis, slipping coins into slots. Next question. Not everybody hates parking meters. One person found a unique way to show their love for the devices. Was it A, an Idaho man who created a private parking meter museum, which was declared illegal because he didn't have enough parking? B, an Oklahoma woman who had one installed on her gravestone set on time expired? Or C, a businessman in Massachusetts installed a parking meter in his office. You want to take up his time, you have to put a coin in.
That's boring, that last one.
I'm
sorry, Mo, you do know we can hear those thoughts. I just wanted you to be, you're actually speaking them aloud. Did you know that?
I just, if it's C, that's going to be a really big letdown. Because that's just not, is it?
All right, well, there's Mo. That's what Mo thinks. But George, what do you think? Was it the parking meter museum?
I thought it was C.
Well, Mo's subconscious leapt out of his mouth to dissuade you. Are you still
No, no, no. I really do. I think it's C.
You think it's C? It'll be a letdown if it is.
I know.
Don't do it.
I'm going for C.
It wasn't C. It was B. It was the gravestone. Barbara Sue Manier's headstone is pretty typical, except it's got an authentic parking meter installed on it with the meter set to time expired. All right. This is exciting. You've got one right with one to go. You get this last one right, you'll win it all. Here we go. Last question. Matt Bonds of Eugene, Oregon was arrested in a parking meter-related incident. He went to jail. What did he do that got him in trouble with the law? A, instead of a quarter, he inserted Necco wafers into them. B, he walked around downtown putting change into strangers' meters, saving them parking tickets. Or C, he stole 674 of them.
What state was this?
This was in Eugene, Oregon.
Eugene, Oregon.
Oh, no, no. Oh.
B.
So you're going to go for B? He put quarters in people's meters?
Yes.
You're right!
He did it!
Way to go, Rose. What happened was Mr. Bonds got mad at a parking meter attendant, and to have his vengeance, he walked around and shoveled change in dozens of meters. He was arrested and charged with, quote, harassment and obstruction of governmental administration, unquote. Carl, how did George Porter do in our quiz?
All I can say is congratulations, George. You had two correct answers. You win for Rose Kupka.
Yeah, you're right. Well done. Well done. Ooh. George Porter Jr. is the bassist for the legendary New Orleans band, The Meters. He's also part of the Running Partners. George Porter Jr., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
What a pleasure.
Branford Marsalis also grew up in New Orleans, part of a family of musical royalty.
He joined us along with Roy Blunt Jr., Roxanne Roberts, and Charlie Pierce, and we asked him how he ended up choosing his instrument, the saxophone.
I was playing clarinet in the orchestra and in the marching band, and I was playing piano, because piano was my first instrument, in this rock and roll band. And there were these pianos that are, they have a resurgence now, these electric pianos called Fender Rhodes. And my dad had one, so I would borrow his, and it weighed about 110 pounds. And I had to carry it by myself. And after about 6 months of that, the tenor guy quit, and I couldn't wait to get a saxophone just to get off of that heavy, damned instrument. And it worked. I lobbied. I got another guy who was stupid enough to carry it around. my good friend Kermit Campbell, who lives in Dallas now, and he started playing piano, and I started playing saxophone.
Because the reason I ask is we heard a rumor, and I want you to see if you can confirm it, that that the ladies like the saxophone for some reason.
Oh, man, that's not a rumor. Like, come on, what makes you think that's a rumor? I mean, look at all the movies. I mean, as soon as a guy gets near the woman, what do you hear? The saxophone. There's a reason for that. But at the age of 14 or 15, when I really wasn't getting any girls and wasn't hip to that, I've often said in jest, you know, I had to switch to a saxophone because you could get women with a saxophone. And I will concede that you stand a much better chance playing a saxophone than you do playing an electric piano.
Yeah. But, I mean, just the lack of hernias alone would be...
There you go.
Well, wait, let me ask then. What makes a saxophone so sexy?
I have no idea. It's something that... It's not that I made the decision. It's just you play and women go, ooh, I like the saxophone. I don't know why. I've never heard... I've just never heard a movie or a show or in real life a person come and say, you know what really turns me on? Fender Rhodes. I just love those guys. Electric keyboards? Oh, the DX7 is just so sexy. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen.
I cannot
tell you why, but I'm glad that it's the way it is.
Apropos of nothing, is it true that all oboe players are virgins?
You know, that might be true. I don't know if it's true, but I would understand why if it were.
Well, Branford Marsalis, we are delighted to have you with us. In fact, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
I don't care what it is. Get me something for the little brats. Stat!
Oh, good.
We're going to ask you three questions about the 10 worst toys of all time published by Radar magazine. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice and their home answering machine. So, Carl, who is musician Branford Marsalis playing for?
Branford is playing for Nathan Neese of Petaluma, California.
All right, here's your first question. Decades ago... countless children were injured, put at risk by toys that were made and sold before the modern innovation of massive lawsuits. For example, in 1951, you could have been one of the first kids to own what? A, a little Daniel Boone genuine backwoodsman fire starter set with flints, kindling, and something called magic Indian fire water, namely butane. B, the U-238 Atomic Energy Lab, a science kit that came complete with real uranium. Or C, the Paul Bunyan two-handed, kid-sized ripsaw.
Given my limited knowledge of pop culture, I'm going to have to go with A.
You're going to go with A, the little Daniel Boone genuine backwoodsman fire starter set.
Yes.
No, I'm afraid it was actually the U-238 Atomic Energy Lab.
You've got to be kidding.
With the real uranium?
Came with actual radioactive, lightly radioactive, gently radioactive uranium-bearing ore and experiments you could do with it. It also had a comic book that was titled Learn How Dagwood Splits the Atom.
Wow.
No, we looked into it. Apparently, it didn't hurt anyone that we know of, but then again, you know, maybe the children were kept in the cellar for the rest of their unnatural lives
exactly.
After playing with it. We don't know. All right, you have two more chances. Let's see if you can get this one.
Okay.
No, that was a hard one. We'll see if you can get this one. Toy guns, of course, always been controversial, but maybe none more than which of these? A, the Bat Masterson Derringer belt gun, which had a working cap gun built into a belt buckle. B, the Commie Killer Army rifle, marketed at the height of the Cold War. Or C, the Ida Lupino girl gun, made of pink plastic, which came with a toy purse to hide it in.
Oh, this is terrible. They all sound so plausible. I'm going to go with Ida Lupino.
You're going to go with the Ida Lupino girl gun.
Yes, I have to.
Pink plastic gun for your little girl.
I think it's plausible.
It's plausible, but I'm afraid the real one was the Derringer belt gun.
Oh, the cap gun?
The cap gun on the belt buckle.
Peter, can I tell you something?
What?
I had one of those.
You had a Bat Masterson belt buckle gun?
I did, yes.
And it's actually in the belt buckle.
It is.
So if you wanted to shoot somebody.
You flip open the belt buckle, and the thing goes off, and you shoot the bad guy.
Wow. Or yourself.
If you put the belt on backwards, then you get in real trouble.
All right, well, you still have one more chance, Brandon. Let's get this one.
Sorry, Petaluma. That's right.
Our last bad toy was related to one of the iconic toys of the 80s. Was it A, the Cabbage Patch Snack Time Kid doll, whose motorized mouth would eat anything, including children's hair and fingers? B, the Be a Smurf makeup kit, which turned dozens of kids a bright blue color that stayed on for weeks? Or C, the Care Bear Bear Trap of Love, which had surprisingly strong steel springs hidden underneath the plush padding?
Okay.
If you love me, you'll chew off my leg.
Man, I don't know. I'm going to go with the Smurf ink.
Smurf
stuff.
Ink. Little kids changing themselves into little Smurfs and not being able to change back.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that one.
No, it was the Snack Time Kid doll.
It was the
Cabbage Patch doll. It had a little motorized mouth, which was supposed to chew up little bits of fake food that came with it. I'm sorry.
And the great thing was, Peter, you could use it to save the little Care Bear.
That's true.
Oh, man.
Well, the game was like some of the best jazz. It's inaccessible, you know.
That's a good point.
Yeah, you are. Carl, how did Branford Marsalis do in our quiz?
Well, he needed two correct answers to win. Branford had no correct answers, Peter.
Oh,
that's terrible. I'm so
that's
sorry.
That's beyond terrible.
That's
just,
not good.
That's just sorry. Well, I mean, I learned a lot. That's very informative stuff.
Yeah, and you can use this.
I shall be.
Inspire.
I'll be using it. I'll put it into my new works.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
A little jazz improvisation on the
I
subject.
I like the other one, the bear trap of love. I'm going to use that one. I think I used the bear trap.
Branford Marsalis is a Grammy Award-winning saxophonist, musician, and composer. He's played with everyone from Miles Davis to Sting, which pretty much is the whole spectrum of music right there. Branford Marsalis, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What fun.
Thank you.
Great to see you. This week, we are listening to people we normally, we listen to. It's an all-musicians edition of Wait, Wait. Not long ago, we were joined by Neil Sedaka, one of the great American pop singer-songwriters, the guy who gave us Calendar Girl and Breaking Up Is Hard to Do and dozens of other hits.
Finally, somebody who knows how to rock. Well, when Neil was on, our panelists were Luke Burbank, Roxanne Roberts, and Tom Baudette. We started by asking Neil how he got started.
Well, I started as a concert pianist at the Juilliard here in New York. And then I got into crazy rock and roll, and I've been doing it for more than 50 years.
Oh, my gosh. Now, we heard that you published your first song when you were 13. Is that right?
Not quite. My first published song was 16.
16. Well, what were you writing about? It was like doing homework is hard to do?
I was writing teenage music for a teenage market.
Oh, really? So what was it that made you change? You were at Juilliard, you're studying classical music, and then you said to yourself, oh, I want to get into this pop music thing because the groupies are better? What was your...
I wanted to make money.
Ah, that.
It's nice to play a Beethoven sonata, but it's nicer to make money.
Right. And did your parents approve of this move to vulgar popular music?
They hated it.
Really?
Oh, they were horrified. They said, there's a million people who could sing and write songs. You have to be a concert pianist. But I bought my mother a mink stole. She was over the moon, so happy.
Really? You're telling me you bought her off?
Yes.
So you started, you eventually ended up at the legendary Brill Building, right?
We used to write from 10 in the morning till 5 at night, 5 days a week, $50 a week. To write songs. What is, a crazy way to make a living.
Now, this is a famous time and place in American musical history because it was sort of like a pop song factory there in on Broadway, was it? In Manhattan?
That's right, yes. And Carole King was there, Neil Diamond, Paul Simon, Tony Orlando. It was a nice group. And we wrote these songs, and my first songs were recorded by Connie Francis, and a lot of songs for her, and then Bobby Darin and Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley, but I'm name-dropping.
So you had all these amazing amazing hits that we all remember still being played today through the 60s. In fact, there's that famous line, it's in the chorus of Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. What is it, like down, doobie, do, down, down?
Those are some of my best lyrics.
Don't you think?
Absolutely. When I ran out, I put in a doobie-doo.
Really? You were known for this. You were like the doobie-doo guy.
That's right.
Did you write them out, doobie-doo, down, down?
I did indeed.
Right. Now, you had all these songs during the 60s, and then in the 70s, things changed. I mean, things bifurcated. There was like disco on the one hand, and there was punk and hard rock and the other. I mean, was it difficult for you then as musical styles started to change?
Well, I used to walk down the street and people asked, didn't you used to be Neil Sedaka?
And what did you say?
I said, well, I'm still Neil Sedaka. Well, you haven't heard the last of me.
So you managed. Did you change your style? Or did you just keep writing your own songs? And
I had to change my style. It was the early 70s. And I met a guy by the name of Elton John. Do you ever hear of him?
I've heard of him. He had funny glasses, if I remember correctly.
Yes, he put me on his record label in the early 70s, and I had a big comeback, Laughter in the Rain, and an album called Sedaka's Back.
There was one thing I wanted to ask you about. You did a song for Captain and Tennille in the 70s, right?
Yes, I wrote a song called Love Will Keep Us Together.
And that became their huge signature hit. That was their song, right?
Thank you for remembering.
Absolutely.
I'm very happy I launched them.
Not a night of karaoke goes by in this country that song is not performed over 100,000 times.
It's true.
As long as they remember the words.
That's true.
Well, they're on a screen if you forget them.
Hey, before we move on to the game, I wanted to ask you about your new record. You just put out a record of your own songs, you performing them, just like in the old days. There's a song on it that you wrote when you were a teenager.
Yes, the only old song, I was 16 years old, it was a doo-wop song. I actually started a doo-wop group in high school in New York called the Tokens. Do you remember the Tokens?
Yes.
What was their hit?
The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
That's it.
That is correct.
In the Jungle, the Mighty Jungle. Very good.
That is correct.
Well, Neil, are you ready to play the game?
I'm not sure.
All right. Well, you've done so far so good, so we'll see what happens now. Neil Sedaka, we're so delighted to have you. We've invited you here to play a game that we're calling...
Oops, we can glue that back together, right?
You may have heard that a visitor at the Metropolitan Museum of Art tripped and put her hand right through a masterpiece by Picasso. This, it turns out, is not the first time this sort of thing has happened, not by a long shot. We're going to ask you about 3 more instances that prove that God really, really does not seem to like the fine arts. Answer 2 questions out of 3 correctly. You will win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is Neil Sedaka playing for?
Neil is playing for Tim Brown of Collinsville, Connecticut.
Ready to play, Neil?
Why not?
Here we go. Here's your first question. In 2000, a drawing by modern artist Lucian Freud worth more than $100,000 came to a bad end in London. What happened? A, somebody was smoking a cigarette and leaned too close to take a look at it.
B, it was put through a shredder, or C, it was mistaken for a child's drawing and thrown out?
I say A.
You say A. Somebody smoking a cigarette leaned too close and poof. That's your guess?
Yes.
I'm afraid it was B. It was put through a shredder.
Oh, boy.
Hadn't even been taken out of its packaging when an overzealous person at Sotheby's Auction House put it into the shredder. All right, you still have two more chances here.
Okay.
A masterpiece by Giorgio de Chirico was hanging in a wall in a townhouse in the Netherlands, perfectly safe, perfectly preserved, when what happened to it? A, a wrecking ball demolishing the building next door came through the wall and smashed it. B, it was hit by a meteor. Or C, the microwave oven on the other side of the wall melted it.
A.
You're going to go for A, the wrecking ball?
Yeah.
You're right. Very good. You said that with such confidence.
I knew it.
That's amazing. All right, well, this is great. You have one more question here. If you get this last one right, you'll win everything. Here we go. The most ironic end to a work of art was probably what happened to an installation by avant-garde artist Damien Hirst in 2001 in London. What was it? A, the anesthetized goat at the center of the piece woke up and walked away. B, a custodian thought the whole thing was just a pile of rubbish and threw it away. Or C, his piece using a whole cow was stolen by a gang of art thieves who took it home and made burgers.
B.
You're going to go for B, the custodian threw it away?
Yeah.
You're right again.
Woo!
Woo, he says. The installation by Damien Hirst was a pile of artfully arranged ashtrays, half-filled cups, and empty beer bottles. So naturally, the custodian thought it was garbage, and he threw it away. He said, quote, I didn't think for a second that it was a work of art. It didn't much look like art to me.
Oh, my Lord.
Carl, how did Neil Sedaka do in our quiz?
Well enough, Peter. Neil had two correct answers, so he wins for Tim Brown.
Well done. Congratulations. I got to ask you a question. Probably, and I know this is a generalization, but if not the most famous, but one of the most famous songs you wrote was Breaking Up is Hard to Do. You've been married to the same woman for 50 years. Is that not true?
Close to 50 years.
Yes.
I was born married.
So how do you know how hard breaking up is?
Well, little did I know when I wrote it how difficult it was. But you know, if you're lucky to have that companion that does it for you, that's a great gift.
Right. So the original, of course, the original title was I Hear Tell That Breaking Up Is Hard to Do.
Well, and I also just rewrote it for my grandchildren. I called it Waking Up Is Hard.
There you go. Neil Sedaka is one of the great singer-songwriters of all time. His new album is called The Music of My Life. Neil Sedaka, thank you so much.
Bye,
y'all.
Joining
us on Wait, Don't Tell Me. Bye-bye.
Bye, Peter. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Don't take your love away from me. Don't you leave my heart in misery. If you go,
all the rap acts these days owe something to Run DMC, the mega hip-hop trio from the 80s. These days, Run has become Reverend Run, an ordained minister with his own reality show on MTV, and a parenting book called Take Back Your Family.
Reverend Run joined Corbett Coleman, filling in for me, and panelists Roxanne Roberts, Mo Rocca, and Adam Felber.
So Run DMC, for those who may not be familiar with your work, you were not the first rap group, but the first superstar rap group, the first rap group that was in the cover of Rolling Stone, the first to sell a lot of records. Is that about right?
Yep. We had a major crossover hit with Aerosmith. It was a remake of Walk This Way.
Right. And where you guys started out, did you know where you were headed? Did you have any idea how big hip-hop and you guys specifically could get?
No, our thoughts were, let's get it on the WBLS was our radio station, so we called in, we had a record, and we act like we were somebody else, as if they knew who we was in the first place. And we're like, Jam Master Jay's name was Jason, and he said, oh, it's Jim, can you play that new record by Run DMC, call it Like That? And we heard that, and then they played the record, and we went running, screaming down the block to our parents, our record's on the radio. And that was, you know, a local radio station, and next thing you know, we were traveling to North Carolina, and we just started moving all around, and it just got bigger and bigger, and it just kept, you know, it got bigger than us and our thoughts.
Now, did you have to put up with, like, people, I don't know if you care, but people saying, well, what kind of musical group are they? They're not even singing.
Exactly. It was really bad. That's a good question. We brought turntables And the promoters would say, "Where's your band?" And we used to say, "In the bag." And it would be two turntables and a mixer. And then once Jam Master Jay finished performing on the turntables, they understood that, we were some bad brothers from Hollis, Queens.
I want to get to what you're doing now, but what you're doing now is so different from those days. So, I mean, did you ever, you know, back in those days, back in the 80s, did you ever turn to your partner and say, "Yeah, this is great, you know, this vast success, international touring, money, but one of these days I'm going to write a parenting book."
No, I didn't think that, but LL Cool J said something to me one day. I used to come out and scream to the audience, "This is my house," but I'd use, you know, a word that I don't want to use now.
Yeah, of course. Cause...
And LL said to me, "One day I could imagine you saying, 'This is my church.'" And he said, "You remind me of a preacher standing up there at the Madison Square Garden in front of all these people." And I just kind of looked at him and smiled, and here it is years later, I'm the Rev Run. So I've always been into touching people in a inspiring way, and that's what I'm doing now with this book and with the television show. Is I believe I'm where I'm supposed to be.
Now let's talk about the television show. The television show is a reality show about you, your wife, and your kids. You live in a big house in New Jersey, and it's vaguely like the shows we've seen before about other families, the Osbournes, whatever you want to pick. But the difference is everybody in your family is really nice, has their act together, and you all get along, which is something.
Well, people like that. You know, we had to shove that down MTV's throat. They were like, "You mean to tell me that you're a rapper, become a reverend with a normal family who sits in a tub and tweets out words to people, and you expect people to like it?" And I looked at them and I said, "Yeah."
Wait, back up for a second. I want to hear. You tweet from the bathtub?
Yeah, I send out words of wisdom every morning. That's what I used to do. So I said, "Let's show people what I do." So we just had, the only difference is we had to put some Mr. Bubble there so you didn't see everything.
Right. So you changed it a little bit for TV, because that was my question. I wanted to see how real it was. So in reality, you would not be using the bubble bath. You'd be with your BlackBerry in the bathtub, sending out words of wisdom.
Yeah, I send them out to my friends. But early on, it was about, you know, like 50 friends and a couple of people in the music industry, and now it's hundreds of thousands of people that I send words of wisdom out to every morning. Anybody that wants to join, you can join too and get the words from the tub.
You ever drop your phone in the tub?
No, but recently I had a soap in one hand and the BlackBerry in the other, and I stuck my hand, the wrong hand, in the tub and realized that the soap was up and the BlackBerry was down.
Well, Rev Rum, we're delighted to have you with us, and we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Walk DMC.
So you're Rev Run. You founded Run DMC, so naturally we wondered what might you know about walking, specifically race walking, the comic relief of international... Race walking. This is an athletic event where athletes race against each other, but they're not allowed to run. They can only walk as fast as they can. We're going to ask you three questions about race walking. Get two right, you'll win a prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice on the home answering machine. Carva, who is Rev Run playing for?
He's playing for Amber Barger of Sacramento, California.
Are you ready to play?
Okay.
Here we go. First question. Race walking has its own lingo, of course. You might hear which of these phrases around a race walking meet. A walker with style but not speed is called a race flaunter. B, a particularly good walker, called a super stroller. Or C, the second place finisher is called, of course, the walker up.
I guess B.
You're going to go B, the super stroller. That guy's a super stroller. No, I'm afraid it was C. It was walker up, because they're not allowed to run.
So I had a feeling that was the answer, but I didn't want to win, I guess.
I guess so. Examine your own self-destructive nature. But that's okay, and you still have two more chances. You can still win this. The next question, race walking has played an important part in pop culture. Now, as in which of these? A, Cary Grant's last movie, Walk, Don't Run, in which he plays Cupid to an American race walker and his young female landlord. B, the original video for Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind featured world record holding race walker Anatoly Vedyakov showing how many roads a man must walk down. Or C, Maurice Ravel said the stately march toward a climax in his famous piece Bolero was inspired by watching a race walk.
C.
You're going to go for C, that the Bolero was inspired by a race walk?
Yeah.
You think?
Mm. Yeah, man.
No, it was actually, it was A, Cary Grant's last movie was called Walk, Don't Run.
I figured that.
Yeah.
He didn't want to flaunt.
All right. He didn't want to flaunt. Here's the last question. Now, one of the things about race walking is, well, why don't these guys just start running? It would be faster. Thanks to an experiment carried out by an investigative TV show, we know a race walker will in fact run if A, he thinks nobody's watching, B, the running surface is heated to 200 degrees, or C, he is attacked by sword-wielding samurai.
I like A already, straight off the top.
You think he thinks nobody, you think if you take a race walker, you say, oh, nobody's watching, you just race walk, we'll go.
You think, listen, if it's wrong, I'm telling you it sounded right to me.
All right, so you're going to choose a race walker. That may well be true. We don't know because we've always watching them. What was proved on TV is that a race walker will start running if he's attacked by samurai. This was done in a Japanese TV show, of course, where they got an actual world champion race walker. They didn't tell him what was happening. They put him on a track. They said, we just want to see your technique. And he was race walking around, and they released six guys with samurai swords to chase him. And you better believe he started running. And we will post a link to this amazing video on our website. Corva, how did Rev Run do?
Well, I can tell you the Rev Run is a very blessed man, Peter.
Well, but thank you very much, but I lost badly.
You lost. You lost them all, Rev.
Yeah. Oh, well.
You got none right.
Rev Run is the star of Run's House at MTV. He's co-written the new book, Take Back Your Family, with his wife, Justine. He'll, of course, always be the Run in Run DMC. Rev Run, thank you so much for joining us here on Wait, Wait. We're so
glad
to have
you. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye. That's it for our Musicians of Music special. Support for NPR comes from CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. The Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And Frederica and Howard Stevenson, supporting NPR. And their local stations WBUR and WGBH to help us understand our world. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. BJ Liederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to our panelists. Thanks to all of our guests. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR.